Thank you. May it please the court. My name is Scott Thompson. I'm here to argue for the end of this pernicious practice of compelling waivers of post-conviction relief from criminal defendants. I submit that it is a practice that is not only cumbersome in its application, but it rests on dubious ethical grounds. The court will note that the motion court in this case chose not to enforce the waiver it extracted from Mr. Krupp in this case. It wrote in its findings that it ought to enforce the waiver. It wrote that a movement had effectively waived post-conviction relief, but it did not enforce the waiver. And I believe its decision to rule on the merits of the case should be granted some measure of deference by
this
court.
That's not entirely true, isn't it? The motion court found that Jackson controls, but then elected to go ahead and rule the merits of the 2915 motion. That's not quite the same as saying the waiver wasn't enforced, is it?
I would disagree in the sense that I think the gratuitous discussion contained in those findings was of the waiver. If the court was genuinely convinced that the waiver was voluntary and intelligent, it would have enforced it without further discussion of the merits of the claim. So I think that implicit in this finding is some uncertainty by the circuit court as to the validity of that waiver. And I think that this case is an example of how these waivers are really cumbersome in their application. The court here had to write findings that were effectively twice as long as if it had ruled merely on the merits of the claim. Waivers, I think, also basically present more problems than they create more problems than they were intended to solve. Mr. Krupp's complaints were of ineffective assistance of counsel. But post-conviction relief is permitted by this court's rules encompass a variety of complaints, such as the jurisdiction of the trial court or the length of the sentence allowed by statute. If a defendant was indeed sentenced to more time than permitted by the statute, would the court compel that defendant to serve his sentence merely because he had waived post-conviction relief? I think these waivers represent using a sledgehammer when really just a gentle tap would do.
Does the defendant get any consideration for the agreement to waive?
I think it's impossible to tell on the record of this case. I think that is one of the arguments that the state has promoted in endorsing the waiver in this case and in Mr. Cooper's case, that there's some benefit that flows to the defendant for having waived, but it's impossible to tease out the benefit from waiving post-conviction relief from the benefit of say, waiving trial or agreeing to a particular waiving direct appeal.
The case law teaches us that for the waiver to be valid, that there has to be an intelligent waiver and a benefit of the bargain. What was the benefit of the bargain in this case?
I don't know, Judge. I don't know what the benefit of the bargain was, whether Mr. Krupp was granted this package deal on sentencing by virtue of his decision to waive direct appeal, by virtue of his decision to later plead guilty on other counts that had been severed for trial.
He did get a reduced sentence option.
He did.
And the prosecutor said he must waive both. So one can assume that he received the benefit for waiving both.
Right, but I don't know that it's crystal clear from this record, and I think our case law about determining whether or not these waivers are voluntarily made and intelligently entered requires some clarity from the record as to whether that waiver was truly voluntary.
And is it your argument that you cannot make a waiver ever, or that you need to make sure it's voluntary by having independent legal advice?
The latter, Judge. I think that waivers are possible. I counsel people every day in the course of my work to waive post-conviction relief. I can do so with a clear conscience because I am neutral counsel. I have no stake in the subject matter of that post-conviction case.
And you say you do that every day. That brings up the practical problem. If we were to require independent counsel as a practical matter, would you have to have two public defenders from different offices? How would you effectuate such a requirement?
I wouldn't ask for the court to order that, and that's why I'm suggesting that the imposition of these waivers and their application is really more cumbersome and creates an extra layer of post-conviction scrutiny that's totally unnecessary.
Your opponent, the state, argues that formal opinion 126 is being read a little bit too broadly by you. Can you address that argument?
I'm not suggesting that formal opinion 126 makes this the conviction and sentence void merely because there was a waiver. I'm suggesting that there are really only two possibilities that could exist here. Either Mr. Krupp entered this waiver of important rights completely uncounseled and without the assistance of counsel, or he did so on the advice of counsel who was laboring under a conflict of interest because Mr. Noble's professionalism would have been the subject matter of a later post-conviction proceeding.
Doesn't there have to be a determination of an actual conflict as opposed to a potential conflict of interest, however? And given some of the express findings of the trial court here with regard to the very precise questions asked of this defendant about were there witnesses that you would have wanted to have called, were, you know, there were very specific questions that now relate, in fact, to the very issues raised in his post-conviction relief motion. Is it not possible that we would require a finding of an actual conflict before there's an issue?
Well, I think the way that the case law reads now, there is the validity of these waivers and whether or not an actual conflict existed is, I think, what the Simpson versus State case comprehends when it suggests that even when there has been a waiver, one presumably that the trial court found voluntary and intelligent, the trial court must nevertheless still appoint post-conviction counsel to evaluate that waiver. I don't know how the waiver could be evaluated in any other fashion than one would work up an ordinary post-conviction case. The obligation on appointed counsel, typically a public defender, is to meet with his or her client, to evaluate the records, review the claims, demand a hearing on the validity of the waiver. This is all the sort of things that would necessarily And at that hearing address whether there was an actual conflict of interest.
Well, wouldn't that then be the end of the inquiry? Assuming you're correct about that, and they filed an amended motion, and that the amended motion alleged that the waiver was not voluntarily and intelligently given, and then whatever else it might allege. But if the trial court or the motion court in this instance determined that it was voluntarily and intelligently waived, then that would be the end of the inquiry.
Yep,
why wouldn't that be the case? I mean, the federal courts have done it. Anyway.
In the wake of a hearing like that, if the record conclusively refuted the claim that it was not voluntary and intelligent, and the court made detailed findings, then yes, I suppose that would be the end of the issue. My point is that this is really as much time and effort for the state, for the court, and for the post-conviction counsel as would be litigating the merits of the complaint.
But does that provide? I'm sorry.
Isn't that what we do generally? I mean, that's the difference between a post-conviction motion where you have a trial and a post-conviction motion where you have a plea. Is when you attack it after a plea, you're looking at whether or not it was intelligently and voluntarily given, at least as it relates to these waivers. And if it was, then that's kind of the end of the inquiry. What makes this any different of an issue if we're dealing with what makes this waiver issue any different than any other constitutional waiver?
Because it's made in the absence of counsel. I don't think that trial counsel, if he or she is going to be the subject matter of that post-conviction case, can offer conflict-free advice. They cannot ethically
But doesn't that circle back to the question with respect to potential conflict versus actual conflict? And what, how do you address the United States Supreme Court precedent that indicates potential conflict does not result in the conclusion that a conviction needs to be reversed?
I don't know that I'm entirely prepared to address that. I will say that in both Mr. Krupp's case and in Mr. Cooper's case, the motion court at least had sufficient difficulty with whether this was a voluntary and intelligent waiver such that it would not enforce the waiver. I guess getting back to Judge Fisher's question, I think there are waivers being made every day. Another reason why formal declarations, signed agreements, contracts are really sort of an unnecessary and cumbersome gloss on the post-conviction rules. Defendants who plead guilty waive post-conviction relief every day when they offer their opinion as to the adequacy of counsel, when they suggest that witnesses have been examined. And I don't know that obtaining waivers relieves the trial court of its obligation to inquire as to the adequacy of counsel.
In this context, what's the difference between an actual versus a potential conflict? I mean, if counsel, in fact, was ineffective, if they know they haven't researched or haven't investigated or whatever the issue may be, is that inherently an actual conflict? Or
I think the conflict is that the trial counsel purporting to give advice about waiving post-conviction relief doesn't know what he doesn't know. If he has genuinely made a mistake as to the law or as to the range of punishment or as to parole eligibility, he can't give intelligent advice to his client. And I think that's the problem. It's not a conflict in the sense that, you know, the attorney would be the subject matter, you know, a subject of some discipline or something, but rather that, you know, if the attorney truly is ineffective, he or she may not know just how ineffective they are.
So what would effective assistance in this regard entail? Would you have to have an opportunity to study what had been done and decide if it was sufficient, or do you just need someone who will come in and explain what it is you're really waiving and you can't know at this point if there's things you might want to raise? Or
I would say the latter, Judge. I think that for it to be an intelligent waiver, the defendant who's contemplating a waiver of post-conviction relief should be given the benefit of a second opinion, you know, by somebody who's looking at the case and can sort of do this review. And I just don't think that's feasible. So I think these waivers, the court should speak with some clarity and suggest these waivers are really not binding and should defer to the motion court here and rule on the merits of the case.
Just from a practical standpoint, don't you then create a perpetual problem? Because if this newly appointed counsel for the purpose of advising on the waiver of post-conviction relief does not know what he or she does not know, then have you not created the same predicament, that person, by not knowing whether they're providing adequate or competent advice, has in effect permitted a defendant or advised a defendant to waive rights that could otherwise have resulted in some relief?
I agree that's a possibility. Lawyers make mistakes. I've got a note on my argument here to button my jacket because I've stained my shirt today. I mean, there are going to be the mistakes that occur. I say it's more cumbersome to have this waiver process in place because it requires the assistance of neutral counsel, and it really creates more problems than it solves. So I'm asking the court to defer to the motion.
If this court were to reject your argument that we prohibit waivers altogether, but we're looking for ways to make the process fair to everyone and not unduly cumbersome, do you have a procedure that you think is the preferred procedure? Are there states that have this, that have a procedure that works? Or do you think you can't have a procedure that's practical and effective?
I've thought about this, Judge, and I can't think of a practical solution to that that wouldn't create basically sort of a dual post-conviction proceeding, sort of pre-conviction and post-conviction. I suggest that the court should abide by the rules that are currently in place and reject these waivers because they are sufficient to address post-conviction relief.
Are we taking away a right from a defendant to have that be a part of a bargain, that they may not have much other capital to use in the bargain, and so if we follow, are we prohibiting a defendant who could make a knowing waiver from receiving a more favorable plea bargain?
I don't think so. I mean, I suppose that a particularly sophisticated movement could suggest that he might, he or she might waive post-conviction relief.
Because the problems you're suggesting may, if in fact the defendant, there's the potential or actual conflict, the problem may solve itself if it's so burdened that it can't really be carried out and you have to go through extra steps, then practically speaking, the problem may go away. It may be so burdensome the prosecutors don't want to include that in a plea bargain. And my question is that a better solution than prohibiting a defendant from having that as a valid option if a waiver is properly done?
I can think of one situation in which a waiver might be validly entered. If a defendant were to waive against the advice of counsel, then I suppose it's his prerogative to use that bargaining chip. But in the absence of, on the advice of a lawyer with a conflict, I don't think it could ever be truly voluntary and intelligent.
Are there any more questions? Thank you.
May it please the Court. First of all, as to address the difference between the actual and the potential conflict, I think what the formal opinion postulates is a potential conflict and nothing more. Now, certainly there is a possibility that an actual conflict could exist. Now, where that would actually come up, I don't believe is in
What's the effect of the formal opinion? Is it a shield versus a sword? What is the, is it something that governs the lawyers or, I mean, what's the effect of the formal opinion?
A formal opinion should guide attorneys in assessing their own actions and everything for ethical purposes. An ethics opinion does not have any sort of binding precedent on case law, and it cannot affect the validity of this waiver. All it can affect is disciplinary proceedings, potentially, and that's, you know, it can potentially guide an attorney as to the ethicality of their own conduct.
Has there been any disciplinary proceedings following up on these waivers?
I am not aware of any, but I honestly don't know. I'm guessing probably not, because from what I understand, a lot of people are now avoiding these waivers just out of fear that this ethics opinion is enforced and might result in problems.
But there wasn't any allegations in this case of any actual misactions by this defendant's attorney, was there?
No, and that's part of the problem, is that if you want to prove an actual conflict, I believe a defendant could allege an actual conflict in this situation.
And what is an actual conflict?
An actual conflict in this situation is not the advice whether or not to waive post-conviction rights. The advice where the conflict could arise is the advice as to whether those post-conviction rights would have merit. That is where an actual conflict can arise, and that is the
well,
only
well,
place.
I mean, if you know you haven't done what a reasonable attorney would do, is that the situation you're talking about? Or
no, I think
is
what,
that an actual conflict? Surely.
Well, it can be.
I've been ineffective,
it depends.
But you can't. I'm going to tell you not to be able to put yourself.
It all depends on what you tell the defendant. For example, if I were representing a defendant and I had done something that I knew would result in ineffective assistance of counsel, and the prosecutor had come to the table with an offer saying, look, if your client waives post-conviction rights in exchange for a guilty plea, you know, I'll put the sentencing cap on, you know, I'll even recommend probation. What I would do in order to avoid a conflict, all I have to do to advise my client is, look, this is what post-conviction entails. These are the rights that you would be waiving if you make this agreement. You know, it is your prerogative. Do you want to do this? Now, I would jump into the realm of an actual conflict if I said, you know, these are the rights of post-conviction. I don't think you have any valid claims of post-conviction, so you're really not losing anything here. So, you know, it's okay to go ahead.
So are you saying an appropriate and practical solution might be to have a rule that said an attorney should not take a position on whether his or her client should waive post-conviction rights, but should simply present the information and leave that up to the client to make the decision, or a decision to get outside counsel?
Well, I think that they could still ethically advise them whether or not they thought it was a good deal that the prosecutor was offering, including this post-conviction. What they can't advise them of is whether or not any underlying claims of ineffective assistance would have merit, because the post-conviction rule actually encompasses more.
What if the lawyer said, I think it does have merit?
I think then you absolutely wouldn't have a conflict, because then the lawyer would have been forthcoming. But you have to remember that the post-conviction rule actually encompasses more than just claims of ineffective assistance. It also encompasses all these other claims about excessive sentencing and all that stuff.
Can you address that? Are you
certainly
saying you could waive that? And so if there's a 10-year limit in the statute on your sentence and you got 20 years, you waive that?
Well,
and we can't correct that?
First of all, there would be no conflict with counsel advising you whether or not to waive that aspect of post-conviction. And as to whether or not
that would be sort of ineffective, one would think.
Well, I'm sure it would not be very good advice on counsel, too. It would advise you to waive it under that circumstance if they knew that you were sentenced excessively. But assuming that counsel did advise you still to waive it and you did receive an excessive sentence, I think that the waiver can still be valid. But that doesn't mean that the person is not going to obtain relief, because obviously we cannot sentence people outside of the statutory range.
So how would you get relief?
I think just like as this court did in the Zinna case, it's a habeas case. I think they raise it on habeas because then they're not in breach of their agreement.
And what if the state says when you do your habeas, well, habeas only applies to things you couldn't have raised in the PCR context? You could have raised this and you failed to do it, therefore you've waived it?
Well, I think certainly that is the rule. However, I believe you can overcome the exhaustion requirements through cause and prejudice. And if you can show that your waiver was invalid because counsel was operating under an actual conflict of interest, I don't know that wouldn't get you to cause and prejudice for not raising it earlier.
But if there's no actual conflict, if it's just a mistake we have cases finding it's manifest injustice. But if you've waived it, I'm just wondering how this would play out down the road. And you've obviously thought about it. How would that get around the waiver issue?
I believe that...
How is it cause and prejudice if you knowingly waived it? Because it has to be a cause external to the defense.
Right. Hold on just a moment. Let me catch up with you there. I believe that the reason that it would be okay if we want to allow defendants to raise the validity of the waiver and challenge the validity of the waiver in their post-conviction action, that's fine. That's how the federal courts currently treat these situations, where they allow them, if you're allowed to waive your post-conviction rights in exchange for a sentencing cap or some benefit of the bargain, and then later, for whatever reason, you believe that your waiver was invalid, they allow them to bring that in the post-conviction action that they allegedly waived. And we could do that here.
But in effect, you're saying, one can never waive lack of jurisdiction in general, so waivers really don't apply to that.
Right, it's just not.
And you really can't waive too long a sentence, so even though you're waiving PCR rights, I think opposing counsel was saying what you're really only waiving is the right to claim ineffective assistance of counsel, because you can't waive those other basic kind of rights.
What you're actually waiving is a procedure by which to challenge those things. You're waiving the post-conviction procedure through the rules. You're not waiving your right to challenge an excessive sentence or to challenge jurisdiction of the court. You can still raise those things.
If this court provides another mechanism for raising.
Right, you certainly can still challenge those things. And if this court would like to address, the waiver situation in the post-conviction context and allow them to challenge the waiver in the post-conviction context, the state has no problem with that. But what they must do is they must plead and prove that the waiver is invalid for whatever reason, be it because counsel had an actual conflict or because perhaps maybe it's an unwaivable claim. They still have to plead and prove that in their pleadings in the post-conviction case.
Can counsel have an actual conflict if counsel doesn't know at the time that they've been ineffective, but it turns out later that there was substantial evidence that would have,
Again, I think that goes back to what it is that counsel told the defendant. If counsel told the defendant, look, these are the claims the post-conviction covers, I don't know whether I did anything wrong or not, but if you waive it, you waive the right to challenge that later, I think in that point, there is no conflict, because all he's doing is informing him exactly what the court informs him of. And I think it steps into the actual conflict when he says, look, this is what you're waiving. You don't have to worry about it because I didn't do anything wrong. I was completely effective. Everything's fine.
And so how do we apply that standard here? Because that's not what occurred here.
Well,
we don't
have
a record showing that that's what occurred here, do we?
That's the thing, is that it's the burden of the defendant to plead and prove if something like that happened. I think our record here shows that it was a knowing and voluntary waiver, because we have the court advising the defendant on the record of all of the rights the post-conviction encompasses and assuring that he indeed wanted to waive those rights.
But he didn't say, did your counsel tell you that you should waive your post-conviction rights, and did he simply tell you he didn't inquire into what language the attorney had used, so we don't know anything in the record about what went on between
them. No, we don't know.
Do we need to remand for that?
We don't know what happened in the record between counsel and the defendant in this case, but I don't believe a remand is necessary, and here's why. I think that once you look at the record, and this is what the motion court does, you look at the record, you see if the waiver was knowing, voluntary, intelligent from the record, and
But you're begging the question. You're saying if it depends on what counsel says, and you're saying you can assume from the standard litany that he must have told him that he didn't really have to waive it.
No, that's not exactly what I'm saying. I'm saying if you look at the record and it appears knowing, voluntary, and intelligent on the record because he's aware of his rights and he agrees that he wants to waive them, then I think you enforce the waiver unless and until he pleads and proves in his post-conviction motion that the waiver was invalid because counsel gave him this advice that he didn't have
told
any legitimate
claims.
Told
him to waive it as opposed to simply giving him the information.
I'm sorry, say that again.
And that advice would be he'd have to allege and prove that counsel told him to waive it as opposed to simply making that his choice.
Not necessarily that he told him to waive it, but that he told him that there was no valid claims when he actually assessed his performance.
Plead and prove an actual conflict.
Correct. Yes, that's exactly what he would have to do, and we don't have that here. There's been no...
Let me ask you this and make sure I'm tracking your argument. It seems to me that you agree that the criminal defendant can never waive an involuntary plea based upon conflicting advice given by an attorney with an actual conflict.
Do you mean a plea or the post-conviction rights?
The defendant can never... in his plea, cannot waive the right to bring post-conviction action for an involuntary plea that resulted from advice from the client that, or advice from the lawyer that was subject to an actual conflict.
Let me make sure I'm understanding this correctly.
Yeah, no, that's fine.
Okay, so you're saying that if there was an actual conflict, you know, for example, the counsel advised him, you have no legitimate claims of PCR, go ahead and waive it, it's okay, and then that results in his guilty plea.
That can never be waived.
Correct. I agree that would be an involuntary plea.
That it can be waived if the attorney does not give advice, whether or not there's a actual conflict.
I agree.
But then wouldn't that leave the defendant without the ability to obtain the advice of his counsel about whether or not a plea and such a waiver was advisable?
I don't necessarily think so, because the counsel can still assess the, I guess, how good the bargain is that's being offered and still render advice that does not result in a conflict.
How do you do that? How do you give me advice and not give me advice at the same time? Well, you know, one side, doesn't the counsel have to say, look, here's what they're offering,
mm-hmm.
6 years. And I really think, or don't think, you have any way to successfully prevail in the involuntary waiver, so you ought to take it. I am, by having that potential taken away from the client, doesn't the client have to make the plea decision and the waiver decision absent an important fact, whether a mistake was made at his trial?
Well, I don't think that he's required to know whether or not he would have any legitimate claims of post-conviction relief in order to make a valid and knowing waiver.
Well, how can I waive something if I don't know the validity of my right?
Well, the United States Supreme Court in Ruiz said that whenever we're talking about constitutional rights, all you have to know is the general rights that you are giving up, not the specific details of them. So, for example, you have to know about the right to remain silent. You don't have to know exactly what questions police officers are going to ask you in doing so. You have the right to waive your jury trial, but you don't have the right to know which potential jurors are actually going to be sitting on your trial. And so here, the general rights that they need to be aware of are all of the rights that are available under post-conviction relief. They do not need to know the very specific claims that might be available to them.
Does it matter in that context if the attorney knows or does not know if an error occurred during the trial or during the process?
I think so long as the attorney refrains from assessing their own performance, that it does not matter whether or not they're aware of it.
Even if the attorney knew that their performance was inadequate?
I think even if the attorney knew their performance was inadequate and they refrained from advising the defendant at all as to the assessment and evaluation of his performance,
but
then I think you've avoided
but
the conflict.
Wouldn't I have a duty as an attorney if I knew there was an inadequate act to advise the client of that?
You know, that's a different ethical question, I think, than the one that's posed in the formal opinion. I think certainly a good attorney should, and I think a moral, upstanding, ethical attorney should. However,
so really,
I don't think that necessarily that would mess up the bargain, because what you can do is, as an attorney, say I knew that I rendered ineffective assistance, and, you know, I got this offer from the prosecutor, and I'm looking at it, and my guy can get probation for something that maybe he would have been subjected to 20 years. So he can get probation if he agrees to waive his claim to challenge my effectiveness. And I inform him fully of the fact
that... But you don't inform him fully because you don't tell him I made a mistake.
Well, I inform him fully of the rights that he is waiving. And I say to him something along the lines of, you know, I may have made a mistake, I may not have. You know, that's totally up to...
But that's not, you're saying I may or may not if I know I did. I guess what I'm saying is in the things that cannot be waived, even if the attorney does not give advice, it can't be waived if the attorney had knowledge of an error.
I don't know that that's necessarily true because we allow defendants to waive actual conflicts in other situations. And so if you do have an actual conflict, I don't know why it wouldn't be waivable in this situation.
Yeah, but if it's known. That's fine. Thank you.
Oh, sorry.
the remedy for that is being given up is the right to a new trial. Or to have a trial, potentially.
In the guilty plea context, certainly.
So if the bargain is good enough, it may be beneficial to the defendant to take a certain number of years rather than have to give away that right versus a right to get a do-over.
Yeah, potentially. And the difference, I mean, in the context that we're in where it's after trial, I think if the waiver were to be found invalid, I think we go back to square one, which in this case would be to resentence him without the benefit of the state's recommendation of the 15-year cap, because he's getting his cake and eating it, too, if he gets to just invalidate the waiver and still gets the benefit of the bargain that he entered into of the 15 years. And so if it is invalid and if the defendant pleads and proves that it's invalid, absolutely, we go all the way back to square one.
Of course, if the attorney knew he made a mistake and told the client.
If he knew and he told the client, I think the client still can validly waive at that point.
Yeah.
I mean, having more information than is required is never going to be a problem.
But so you're saying you can waive it as long as you have full knowledge and then you make that decision?
Correct. And what's required for full knowledge is the ultimate question. And I think...
Wouldn't you have an actual conflict, though, and it would certainly be a rare situation, but the situation that Judge Price talks about where you actually knew you'd been ineffective and it would definitely or most likely create a right to have a new trial, and yet you chose not to tell him and instead said, hey, your decision, I can't give you advice. Would that be an actual conflict? And that's a rare, I'm sure, situation. Or
you know,
very difficult to prove.
Well, certainly. I still don't think it would be an actual conflict if the attorney refrained from giving advice as to his own effectiveness.
And don't all of these questions really beg the ultimate question, which is, under any of these scenarios that have been described, it would be up to the motion court to determine whether the facts as pled and proved by the defendant demonstrated an actual conflict that mitigated the knowing and intelligent waiver.
That is correct.
And in the case of a knowing and intelligent waiver, or in the absence of same, it is not a situation where the only remedy that the defendant would get would be the ability to proceed with his PCR proceedings, but rather his guilty plea and or agreement to sentencing would be withdrawn.
Right. That's absolutely correct.
Thank you. Any more questions?
Thank you. I'd ask that you affirm.
Now, your opposing counsel said that people aren't advising of waivers because of fear of formal opinion 126. Would there be circumstances where a waiver would be appropriate that the counsel should advise the client of the potential benefit to the client of a waiver?
Well, I don't know under the state scenario how that would ever be possible. If the lawyer's obligation is to say nothing about his or her own effectiveness, then the defendant would have no way of knowing whether or not to take this post-conviction.
What if the lawyer's obligation includes an obligation in that scenario? If the lawyer prefers to say nothing and not put his or herself in a box, so to speak, in that respect, would it be sufficient for the lawyer to say, on this particular subject, waiver of post-conviction rights, you're entitled to appointment of separate counsel on that issue, if you wish?
Yes, I think counsel can tell his client that, and if counsel is ethical, should encourage the defendant to take that opportunity. But the sad truth is the vast majority of criminal defendants don't have the luxury that we all do of getting second opinions about very serious matters. If we don't like the doctor that we've gone to see, or we disagree with the therapy
plan,
we have the option to go see someone else and get a second opinion.
For practical purposes, how is it qualitatively different to permit me to waive my right to a direct appeal versus permitting me to waive my right to post-conviction relief, if the practical effect is that I may be getting a better offer than the state otherwise would have been willing to make?
It's different for the simple reason that counsel can be expected to offer neutral, objective advice about whether there was trial court error. Trial counsel can say, I think the judge made this decision incorrectly.
Is that really true? What if trial counsel knows that trial counsel failed to tender an appropriate instruction and really doesn't want that to come to light and would just as soon have the defendant waive direct appeal, so that issue is never really vetted through the appellate process?
Then I think we've got, as we were discussing earlier, an actual conflict of interest. I mean, I think just leaving aside for a moment any potential claims of ineffective assistance, I do think advice by counsel to waive a direct appeal is different in kind, in the sense that the lawyer is being asked to assess the adequacy of the trial court and not his or her own performance. So I think those waivers are still valid because they're with the assistance of counsel. And for instance,
well, it could. I think, as Judge Martin pointed out, is there are some things that lawyers come up with on the third or fourth day of trial that make them wish they might have done something different on the first or second day of trial because things didn't turn out like they thought.
Right.
And so if there's a temptation to be kind of look at yourself through a different prism than others look at you, why don't those same problems exist with the direct appeal that would potentially exist with the post-conviction? I mean, if a lawyer is inclined to minimize his own mistakes.
I can imagine, you know, that certain lawyers may try to do so, but I nevertheless still maintain that a lawyer can answer the question of the defendant, hey, do you think the judge made a mistake here? No, and here's why. I think the judge was correct in overruling
the motion
to suppress.
We're dealing with ineffective assistance of counsel, which is often the claim. When you're talking about ineffective assistance of counsel, the lawyer is the one that's involved. I mean, the public defender does have contract attorneys. I mean, there are possibilities for an independent counsel to look at the thing and say, advise a client without giving up the client's right to get some benefit from a waiver if that would help them.
Right, but I don't know that the potential benefit, as I argued earlier, of these waivers necessarily mandates the extra sort of imposition on the public defender system and its resources that procuring conflict-free counsel for every situation where a defendant contemplates waiving post-conviction relief, I think that would just be totally unworkable as the waiver process in general is.
As a practical matter, the comparison to appeal is not really analogous because most times when you're going to have a waiver, it's going to be after a plea, and you're not going to be appealing the merits of some trial or
certainly
mistakes anyway.
In the majority of cases, but I maintain that that the trial counsel can give at least presumably objective advice about whether or not trial court error occurred. Because he or she can answer the questions, the pointed questions of the defendant, do you think any mistakes have occurred? It's unlike the scenario when counsel is advising about post-conviction remedies. It would have to be a very uncurious defendant that said, hey, well, what do you think? Should I waive post-conviction relief? I mean, the only way you can make an intelligent decision is to have all the information.
Is some of that hypothetical concern, though, addressed by the litany of questions that a trial court's in a position to ask with respect and as occurred in this case? Were there any particular witnesses that you wanted called who were not called on your behalf at trial or who were not contacted by your counsel in the preparation for trial in the case of a straight guilty plea?
And
or things along those lines?
Yeah, I think as I argued in my first half, these waivers are being made every day, and there's no reason to have this sort of super waiver because it really is a situation where you're throwing the baby out with the bathwater. There might be other important rights for which the post-conviction rules are an exclusive remedy.
And I guess that's my
point.
We're already, in effect, through that litany, backdooring the waiver because we're effectively letting motion courts determine that there is nothing on the record that permits this case to proceed because the defendant knew precisely what he or she was doing on the plea, what's the practical difference of going ahead and just having the straight waiver up front, perhaps supported by this litany, making it clear that the advice of counsel that was provided permitted a knowing and intelligent waiver?
I think the problem is that you're now adding, you know, sort of an extra litany, and the problem about the advice by the court or the questions by the court of the waiver is, unlike those other questions, the questions about the waiver, the defendant really didn't have the assistance of counsel, if counsel was being ethical and sort of withdrawing from that discussion entirely. The defendant was able to discuss with his lawyer, you know, the investigation done in the case and all his legal rights, not so the adequacy of counsel. And so I think there's a difference there, and I think it's just going to be impossible to determine whether these waivers are voluntary and intelligent. It's possible to do so in the record in this case.
I see you getting your papers together, and I have another question I've been waiting to ask you. Your opponent argues that the remedy is not that the PCR case goes forward, but that the plea bargain is set aside because your client should not get the benefit of a bargain that he has effectively challenged. And clearly you're asking that the PCR case go forward. So can you address that issue?
Right. And I think the notion that that a defendant who has waived his post-conviction rights has somehow put one over on the state or hoodwinked the court by then later filing a post-conviction remedy suggests that the post-conviction remedy is an end unto itself. Indeed, if the bargain struck by the defendant was valid and made in the absence, or in the presence rather, of prepared counsel, it is typically the defendant who ultimately has the most to lose by trying to overcome the waiver.
But if a defendant does overcome the waiver, then the plea bargain was not a valid plea bargain. So why, anytime a defendant challenges that a plea bargain, whatever occurred during the plea bargain wasn't knowingly and intelligently done, isn't the plea set aside?
I would think it almost have to be, Judge, because the way these waivers are typically structured is it's a package deal. You have to take the waiver.
So your client would be subject to being sentenced without the cap.
Right. I mean, I think that was the point I was trying to make that defendants who choose to challenge these waivers, I mean, they have the most to lose.
So that's what, if you persuade us, that's what your client is, that would be the consequence to your client.
Well, not necessarily. I mean, the consequence to my client would be that he should receive a new trial on the basis of ineffective assistance on the part of his trial counsel. I mean, I raised claims of ineffective assistance that affected the outcome of that proceeding.
So you're saying he would go forward with that, but also then there would be no sentencing. So if he's
successful on PCR and say he got a new trial, he couldn't later be heard to complain, well, gosh, I'm entitled to 15 years because that's what I got the first time around. I mean, again, my point
what
being...
What I'm saying is not that he has to succeed in PCR to get a new sentence, but by virtue of being able to have PCR hearing, his sentence would be set aside.
No, I don't think that follows just because the waiver set aside that he would necessarily be resentenced in the absence of a finding of ineffective assistance. Because I think, the court has to show that there was indeed this ineffectiveness. I mean, I'm not aware of any sort of interim clause that suggested that if he challenged the waiver, you know, that he would come back for just automatic resentencing. And I think
if the error was only in the sentencing but not in the conviction, why would it be necessary to retry the case? If the only error in the case was the sentencing.
I suppose if the error was just in the sentencing, but I mean, I don't know that there was anything that was sort of really bargained for any, I mean, he was going to be sentenced because he'd been convicted.
And so he had, if he is successful in finding, setting aside his waiver, then inherently that means the plea bargain was invalid, and therefore he should be subject to being sentenced to the maximum available.
Well, I mean, the plea bargain was invalid, and then additionally, the trial would be invalid. I mean, I think that's the difficulty with these waivers, because it's impossible to sort of tease out how the waiver is separate from other.
I think what Judge Brackenridge's question is going to is the state would argue it's lost the benefit of its bargain if you set aside his waiver of his right to have a PCR hearing, and therefore it's unfair to give him a PCR hearing because it's unfair to the state, so you should just start all over, and he shouldn't get a chance to prove his other allegations.
Well, in this case, it's very unique circumstances. The PCR hearing would just be addressing the underlying trial. In this case, he had a trial, and the plea bargain, there was no trial that governed sentence, right?
The plea bargain, I mean, these counts were severed, and so he had a trial as to the subject matter of this 2915 motion, but then that plea bargain was a separate, an entirely separate post-conviction motion and a separate appeal, the merits of which, I might add, were ruled on by the appellate court.
Are there any more questions? Thank you.